Oh, it's you, Mr. Temple. Oh,
sorry, Charlie, I left my key in the study.
Well, that's all right, sir.
Mrs. Temple in the drawing room?
No, sir. She went out about half an hour ago.
Oh? Where's she gone, do you know?
No, she didn't say. She seemed in quite a flap.
What do you mean, quite a flap?
Well, it was just after she made the phone call. She came into the
what
kitchen...
What phone call? Who did Mrs. Temple ring up?
I don't know, sir. But about 2 minutes later, Mrs. Temple popped into the kitchen and said she was going out.
But didn't she say anything else?
Oh, yes, sir. She said, I'm going out, Charlie, but if Mr. Temple gets home before I get back, just say...
Well, just say what?
Edgar Northampton.
That was the sixth episode of the Francis Durbridge serial, Paul Temple and the Margot Mystery, with Peter Cook as Paul Temple and Marjorie Westbury as Steve. Linda Kelburn was played by June Tobin and Midge Harris by Frank Partington. Production for the BBC was by Martin C. Webster.
Edgar Northampton, eh? Part 7 is on Monday at the same time when Paul edges a little closer to working out who the fence is.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
So now, some more questioning and the big finish down at Smuggler's Island, and Hercule Poirot is hoping for a bit of a rest soon.
It seems that I am fated never to take the holiday without a body turning up to interrupt it. I was staying at the Jolly Roger Hotel on an island off the Devon coast when the corpse of Alena Marshall was found in a deserted bay. She had been strangled. At least three of the guests at the hotel had good reasons to wish her out of the way. And, to further muddy the waters, there were indications of drug smuggling, witchcraft, and blackmail.
We present John Moffat as Hercule Poirot and George Baker as Colonel Weston in Agatha Christie's Evil Under the Sun.
Blackmail, Colonel. I'm sure that's what this is all about. I've been going into the details of Mrs. Marshall's finances with her lawyers. You remember that she was left £50,000 by Sir Roger Erskine?
The old boy who was supposed to have been totally infatuated with her.
That's the one. Well, there's only £15,000 left.
And do we have any idea what's become of it, Colgate?
Well, that's just the point, sir. She seems to have handed it over, either in cash or in negotiable securities, so that it couldn't be traced.
It certainly sounds like blackmail. And from what Mrs. Redfern told us about the conversation she overheard, we have to assume that the blackmailer is someone staying in the hotel. Have you got any more information on the Reverend Lane or Horace Blatt?
Stephen Lane resigned his living in Surrey just over a year ago, owing to what was described as ill health. He was treated for mental illness. It seems he had some kind of obsession about the Whore of Babylon and regarded some of his female parishioners as instruments of Satan.
Well, doesn't help us much with the blackmail angle. But he could have convinced himself that it was his appointed duty to get rid of Arlena Marshall. Far-fetched, I admit. But these things do happen. Did you check on his alibi?
He certainly signed his name in the visitor's book in the church at St. Petrarch. But since the previous entry was 6 weeks earlier, he could have gone over there at any time. It's not conclusive proof that he was there on the day of the killing.
And Horace Blatt?
Oh, there's certainly something pretty fishy going on there. He's been making far more money than his hardware business could ever hope to bring in.
So he could be our blackmailer?
Or it could be dope. There seems to have been a good bit of heroin coming onto the market lately.
If the Marshall woman's death is the result of getting mixed up, innocently or otherwise, with heroin smuggling, then we'd better hand over the whole thing to Scotland Yard. Do you agree?
It seems a very likely explanation.
Have you told Poirot all this?
Oh, yes, I told him. His only reaction was to ask me for information on any strangling cases over the last 3 years.
Did he now? Whenever there's an obvious explanation, trust Poirot to go barking up the wrong tree.
The scent of Gabrielle number 8. A broken pipe stem. A bottle thrown from a window. A piece of green calendar, a girl's wristwatch, someone taking a bath at an unusual time of day. Each of these must be fitted into its correct place. There can be no loose ends. A task for the little grey cells.
Lost in thought, Mr. Poirot?
Not at all, Inspector Colgate. You might say that I am playing a game of patience with imaginary cards.
I've been looking a little further into one of those strangling cases you asked about. The Alice Corrigan murder.
And what have you found, my friend?
She was killed about 12 miles from Weatheridge, where the vicar was a certain Stephen Lane.
Oh, that is very interesting.
The husband was the obvious suspect, since the woman's life had been insured in his favour. But he was washed right out of it. The body was discovered by a passing hiker, a games mistress from a school up north somewhere, at 4:15. Now, Mr. Corrigan was coming back on a train from London and had arranged to meet his wife at a local cafe by the station at around 4:30. He waited there for half an hour and then went off to look for her.
And when did the police examine the body?
At 5:45 or thereabouts. The hiker had to go a fair way to the nearest phone box to report it. But what is really interesting is that the circumstances of the killing are very similar to those of another strangling case, Nellie Parsons, a rather flighty servant girl. And she too was murdered not a dozen miles away from Stephen Lane's vicarage.
It is difficult to know which pieces are part of the fur rug and which are the cat's tail.
What was that, sir?
Oh, I apologize. I was following a train of thought of my own.
Your mind works in a funny way, doesn't it, sir? But I dare say it all comes right in the end. Tell me, why are you so interested in these other strangulation cases?
And it occurred to me that the murder in Pixie Cove might not be the first case of its kind.
That's certainly a new way of looking at it.
I said to myself, let us examine past crimes of a similar kind, and if there is a murder which closely resembles this one, then we may have a very valuable clue.
You mean using the same method of killing?
Oh, I mean more than that. The death of Alice Corrigan. Do you notice one striking similarity to the murder of Arlena Marshall?
No, sir. I can't say that I do. Unless it is that in each case the husband has got a cast-iron alibi.
So you notice that. It is curious, is it not?
I thought you ought to know that I've decided on a course of action, Poirot. But I'd like your opinion on it before I set things in motion.
Go ahead, mon colonel. Tell me what it is.
I think I should call in Scotland Yard and hand the case over to them. Although there may be vague grounds for suspicion against one or two people, I am convinced that the whole thing hinges on heroin smuggling, and that Pixie Cave was a rendezvous for the stuff.
I agree.
Oh, good man. And I'm pretty certain who our smuggler is. Horace Blatt.
That, too, is indicated.
Oh, I see that our minds have been working along the same lines. I think that Arlena was unfortunate enough to arrive at Pixie Cove just at the moment when Blatt was taking the stuff to the cave. She asked him what he was up to. He panicked and strangled her and shoved off in the boat as fast as he could go.
So you definitely think that Blatt is the murderer?
It seems the most probable solution. And I think the best course is to hand the case over to Scotland Yard. They have a much better chance than we have of tracing Blatt's connection with the heroin gang.
Which is possible.
You agree that it's the wise thing to do?
It may be.
Oh, damn it all, man. What's your objection? Have you got something up your sleeve?
If I have, I am not sure that I can prove it.
So what do you think ought to be done about it?
I know what I should like to do.
What's that?
I should like to go on a picnic.
A picnic, Monsieur Poirot? What on earth put that idea into your head?
Oh, surely it is not such an outrageous idea, madame. We need something of the everyday to restore us all to normal. And I am fascinated to see something of Dartmoor.
You want to see the prison?
Oh, no, Mademoiselle Darnley. I wish to see the pixies. Do you remember, Mr. Redfern? You told me that there were places on Dartmoor where the pixies were supposed to live.
Oh, yes, there's Pixies Cave on Sheep's Tor, and there's Pixies Holt, and there's Pixies Bridge.
Then what better reason could there be for a picnic?
You'll have to count me out, I'm afraid, Poirot. I've got a business appointment in Plymouth.
Oh, it will be our loss, Captain Marshall. I trust that the others will be able to come. I shall make arrangements for our transport.
It looks as though it's going to be a lovely day.
It's not really pixie weather, Mrs. Gardiner. I don't think they care much for sunshine.
I'm afraid Linda's not coming, Monsieur Poirot. She says she's got a frightful headache.
But it would do her good to come out with us. It might help to cheer her up a little.
Well, I've tried to tell her that, but it's no use. She's absolutely determined. I've given her some aspirin and she's gone to bed.
I'll stay with Linda. I don't mind a bit.
Oh, no, Christine. You must come with us, darling. I'm sure Linda will be all right on her own.
Well, Mrs. Gardiner, did you have a good day? Were the pixies up to form?
Oh, it was simply wonderful, Captain. The moors were just too lovely for anything.
And I've had a very boring day, going through the books with my accountant. I've only just this moment come back.
Oh, Miss Darnley's gone up to see how your daughter's headache is. Oh, it was such a pity you couldn't be with us. We had a really marvelous picnic, and Monsieur Poirot was in such high spirits. Poor Miss Brewster had rather a funny turn on the way back, though. Oh,
I trust it wasn't serious.
Oh, it was just her vertigo, I think. We were crossing a narrow bridge over a little river, and she suddenly stopped and couldn't go on. She just stood there, swaying backwards and forwards until Mr. Redfern and Monsieur Poirot went to her rescue. Oh, but I better go up and see how my husband is making out. He had one of those Cornish pasty things, and he'll probably have to be in the bathroom for hours.
Kenneth, something's happened to Linda. You'd better come. I just can't wake her.
What has happened? What is the matter?
I've no idea. The doctor's on his way.
We think she may have taken something. It's as if she were in a coma. And there's a letter by the side of her bed. It's addressed to you, Monsieur Poirot. Mm-hmm.
I think this is the best way out. Ask Father to forgive me. I killed Arlena. I thought I should be glad, but I'm not. I am very sorry for everything. Oh, the poor misguided child.
There is a chance she may pull through, but the doctor doesn't offer a great deal of hope.
Oh, the poor kid.
How the hell did she get hold of the stuff?
There was a bottle of sleeping tablets in my room. I think she must have taken them.
Well, how did she know about them?
I gave her one the night after Elena's body was found. She told me she couldn't sleep. I should have kept them locked up.
Oh, it might have been wiser, darling.
You mustn't blame yourself, Mrs. Redfern. She knew what she was doing. But why? What did she mean by that letter?
Oh, she can't have killed Arlena. It just isn't possible.
I fear it is all too possible, mademoiselle.
But I was with her at Gull Cove until 11:45. You know that.
But how do you know? By the evidence of Linda's wristwatch. You do not know of your own knowledge that it was 11:45 when you left her. You only know that she told you so.
Oh, but the whole thing's quite preposterous.
Captain Marshall, in your daughter's room after the murder, I found in the hearth a large blob of melted wax, some burnt hair, fragments of cardboard and paper, and an ordinary household pin.
What's that supposed to add up to?
Tucked away in her bookshelf, I found a book from the local library on witchcraft and black magic. It fell open at a certain page, describing how to cause death by moulding a wax figure supposed to represent the victim and slowly roasting it until it melted away, or by piercing it with a pin in the area of the heart.
So that's what she was doing with those candles.
She twisted a scrap of Arlene's hair around the figure, pierced it with a pin, and melted it in the grate.
But that doesn't mean she killed
her. She could quite easily have done so. If she had changed the hands of her watch, she would have had all the time in the world after Mrs. Redfern had departed to cut across the island, climb down the ladder to Pixie Cove, kill her stepmother, and return by the way she had come.
I don't believe Linda killed Arlena. It's absurd.
And her letter?
I can't account for it.
There are two possibilities. She could have written it knowing herself to be the murderess, or she wrote it to shield someone else whom she felt was suspected.
Meaning me, I suppose. But she knew I was in the clear.
Supposing it was not so much that she thought you were suspected as that she knew you were guilty.
That's absurd.
Is it? You could not have killed your wife if you were acting alone. But supposing someone helped you.
What the devil do you mean by that?
It is quite true that you could not have typed out those letters and at the same time have gone down to Pixie Cove, but you could have jotted down their contents in shorthand for Miss Darnley to type out.
I can't do shorthand. Oh, this is ridiculous.
Is it? Then why did you both lie to me? You told me, Miss Darnley, that you had seen Captain Marshall from the door sitting at the typewriter, but that is not possible. The writing desk is in the corner of the room, and you could not have seen Miss Darnley in the mirror, Captain. It is between the windows and reflects only the wall opposite.
How very clever of you.
But not as clever as the man who did kill Alena Marshall. Think back for a moment. Who did everyone suppose she had gone off to Pixie Cove to meet that morning, huh? Patrick Redfern. And I knew from the look on her face that it was not a blackmailer she was expecting, but her lover.
Well, it certainly wasn't me. Someone must have used my name.
I think not. It is my belief that she went to Pixie Cove to meet you, and that she did meet you there, and that you killed her there, as you had planned to do.
You're mad. You know very well I went round to the beach in the boat with Miss Brewster and found Arlena lying dead on the beach.
Not dead, Mr. Redfern. It was the living body of the woman who helped you. Her arms and legs stained with tan, her face hidden by a large green cardboard hat. Christine, your partner in this crime and in the crime she helped you commit when she supposedly discovered the body of Alice Corrigan at least 20 minutes before she died, killed by her husband, Edward Corrigan. You, Mr. Redfern.
Damn you, Poirot.
No, Patrick. Don't lose your temper.
The Surrey police have already identified you from a photograph taken here at this hotel.
You lousy little worm! You lousy...
Get him off! Get him off!
They've taken them both off to the police station at Leathercombe. How are you feeling, Poirot?
Bruised, but triumphant, mon colonel.
I imagine you'll survive. And Linda Marshall's out of danger, according to the doctor.
Oh, thank God.
I'll go up to her straight away.
Of course. Now, Poirot, I hope you're sufficiently recovered to tell us all what happened.
I'd be so thrilled if you'd allow me to listen, Monsieur Poirot. I've always wanted to know how you solve your crimes.
I would be honored, madame. Oh. It all began that first morning when Arlena Marshall made her entrance onto the beach. We had been talking of the sun-tanned bodies, and I reflected on how little difference there was between one brown body and another.
You said they looked like boiled lobsters.
It was on that morning that I spoke with the Reverend Lane about evil. For him, evil was focused in the person of Alena Marshall, the kind of woman who wrecked lives and destroyed souls.
Well, so she did.
Ah, but I saw her very differently. It was not she who attracted men. It was men who fatally attracted her. In Patrick Redfern, with his good looks and his fine body and his easy assurance, I recognize the type of man who makes his living one way or another out of women, and for whom Arlena Marshall would be his predestined prey.
And, of course, Arlena was quite a wealthy woman. Old Erskine left her most of his fortune.
Not that there's much of it left. 15,000 out of 50.
I have no doubt that Patrick Redfern found it easy enough to induce her to hand over large sums from time to time for investment.
But why did he need to kill Arlena? She was the goose that laid the golden eggs.
Ah, but that is just the point. He had deprived her of most of her private fortune, and this fact could not be kept from her husband for much longer. And once Captain Marshall started to ask questions...
And Christine was in on all this?
Oh, yes. None of this could have been done without her. From the time of their arrival here, she played the part of the poor little wife. Frail, helpless, intellectual rather than athletic.
Oh, quite an accomplished little actress.
Just think of the points she made, one after another. Her tendency to blister, her giddiness at heights.
Well, she told Miss Brewster she got stuck on the outside staircase of Milan Cathedral.
Everyone spoke of her as a little woman, but she was actually as tall as Arlena Marshall. She told people that she had been a schoolteacher as part of her bookish image. In actual fact, she had been a games mistress.
Wow.
A strong young woman who could run like an athlete and climb like a cat.
Hey, just a minute, Monsieur Poirot.
Yes, madame?
Is that why you arranged our little trip to Dartmoor today, so that you could test her out on that nasty little bridge?
How very perceptive of you, madame. People who have a bad head for heights are never comfortable crossing a narrow bridge over running water. Miss Brewster, a genuine sufferer, was rendered quite helpless, but Christine Redfern ran across it without even noticing it.
Oh, that's clever.
But I still want to know exactly how they managed the killing.
I will take you through it step by step. Redfern's first act was to slip out very early by the balcony door, which you noticed, Colonel. Under his bathing wrap, he concealed a large beach hat, the kind worn by Alena Marshall. He crossed the island, climbed on the ladder to Pixie Cove, and hid the hat among the rocks. Step number one.
So he had arranged a rendezvous with Alena?
Yes. She agreed to go there early, and he told her he would join her at Pixie Cove as soon as he could slip away unobtrusively. If Alena heard anyone descending the ladder, she was to hide in the cave, the secret of which he had explained to her, and wait there till the coast was clear. Step two.
You said you could smell Gabrielle number 8 in the cave. It was hers, of course.
Exactly, mademoiselle. In the meantime, Christine was in Linda's room at the time she calculated she would have gone out for her swim. She altered Linda's watch, putting it forward 20 minutes. While she was there, she noticed the book on witchcraft and black magic. And when Linda returned and dropped the package of candles, she realized exactly what was in the girl's mind. It opened up new possibilities. The original scheme had been to throw suspicion onto Kenneth Marshall, hence the fragment of a briar pipe at the bottom of the ladder.
Oh, what a ruthless little bitch.
Christine went back to her own room, took out a bottle of artificial suntan, applied it carefully, and threw the empty bottle out of the window.
Oh, it nearly brained Miss Brewster.
So that was why you were so obsessed about that bottle.
Uh-huh. She then dressed herself in a white bathing suit and then put on a pair of floppy beach pajamas which effectively concealed her artificial suntan.
And I put it down to her hopeless dress sense.
It also effectively concealed her watch from Linda. Mm. At Gull Cove at 11:25, she asked Linda what time it was. Linda's watch showed 11:45. Christine began to pack up her sketching things and Linda set off for a bathe. As soon as her back was turned, Christine put Linda's watch back to the correct time. She went up the cliff path and ran across the island to the top of the ladder down to Pixie Cove. She stripped off the beach pajamas and climbed rapidly down the ladder.
And she must have been the last person Alena expected to see, her lover's wife. No wonder she hid in the cave.
Mm. Christine took the green hat from its hiding place and lay face down on the sand with the hat concealing her face. The timing is perfect. A minute or two later, the boat comes round the point. Remember, it is Patrick who first sees the body and who bends down to examine it. Miss Brewster does not see the face concealed beneath the hat. She sees only a suntanned body.
Oh. And because she suffers from vertigo, she has to go the long way back by boat.
Christine cuts up the cardboard hat with her scissors and stuffs the pieces into her beach bag, climbs back up the ladder, slips into her floppy beach pajamas, and runs back to the hotel. There is just time for her to have a quick bath and wash off the suntan lotion. Oh,
I couldn't understand why you were so keen to know who had a bath around 12 o'clock.
She burned the pieces of the sun hat in the hearth in Linda's room and added a scrap torn from a calendar so that it would appear to be a calendar that had been burned.
And then she came and joined us for our game of tennis. No wonder she looked a bit flustered.
Meanwhile, Patrick had gone back to the cave. Alena could have seen nothing from there and heard only the faint sound of voices. Patrick called her to tell her that all was clear. She came out and he strangled her. And that was the end of poor, beautiful Alena Marshall.
Oh, what a thing to do.
And am I to understand that they played the same game over the Corrigan murder?
A very similar game. Again, it involved juggling with time. Christine appeared to be a totally independent witness, a passing lady hiker. She said that she had stumbled upon the body at 4:15. Patrick's alibi effectively covered him until 4:30. He sat in a cafe, apparently waiting for Mrs. Corrigan, and made certain that he was noticed, after which he went to the rendezvous which he had actually arranged with her and murdered the poor woman.
Ingenious. The police had no reason to question the alibi. with which Christine had supplied him.
And it was the similarity between the two cases. The corpse discovered before the actual time of the murder that convinced me I was right. All that was necessary was to goad Patrick Redfern into giving himself away. Ha ha ha, it was a little rash, perhaps, exposing myself to danger, but it succeeded.
Well, Monsieur Poirot, it's been wonderful hearing how you get your results. It's every bit as fascinating as a lecture in criminology. In fact, it is a lecture in criminology.
But I still don't understand how Linda came to believe that she had killed Arlena.
Remember that she is really little more than a child. She hated Arlena. She deliberately made that wax image, cast her spell over it, pierced it to the heart, melted it away, and on that very day, Arlena dies. Older and wiser people than Linda have believed in magic. And Linda was convinced that by using magic, she had killed her stepmother.
And I imagined something quite different. That she knew something which would...
I know what you imagined. And the way in which you reacted made Linda think that you knew what she had done. And Christine deliberately worked on her, gave her the idea of the sleeping tablets.
So that everyone would believe she'd done it. But you're sure Linda will be all right?
Well, that I suspect. Maybe up to you, mademoiselle.
But it's just the same as if I had killed her, isn't it? I meant to.
It is not at all the same thing. The wish to kill and the act of killing are different things. If, in your bedroom, instead of the wax figure, you had your stepmother bound and helpless, and a dagger in your hand instead of a pin, you would not have pushed it into her heart.
I suppose that's true.
It was silly. It was childish. But by doing what you did, you took the hatred out of yourself and put it into that little wax figure. And when you burnt it in the fire, you destroyed not your stepmother, but the animosity you bore her.
Yes, I did feel a kind of relief at first. But then I got frightened.
Ah, well, let it be a lesson. Just make sure you don't hate your next stepmother.
My next stepmother?
Hmm.
Oh, you mean Rosamond. Do you really think there's a chance?
A very good chance, I should say.
I don't mind her. She's sensible. I think we'll get on very well.
I'll tell you one thing, Poirot. The next time I hear you going on and on about a bottle thrown out of a window or a bath being emptied, I shall treat what you say with the greatest respect.
And how is the case proceeding against Mr. Blatt and his heroin smuggling?
Well, I'm advised that there is insufficient evidence to convict. But I shall get him in the end.
Yes. He's a little too, how do you say it, cocksure. And I do not think I shall follow his advice.
And what was that?
He said that I would do better to spend the summer holidays at Deauville or Le Touquet. But I think that I would prefer somewhere far away from beaches and parasols and pedalos. I never wish to lay eyes on a sun-tanned body again.
In the final part of Agatha Christie's Evil Under the Sun, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat and Colonel Weston by George Baker. Captain Marshall, Robin Ellis. Linda Marshall, Lindsay Fawcett. Patrick Redfern, Ian Glenn. Christine Redfern, Susanna Corbett. Rosamund Darnley, Sabina Franklin. Mrs. Gardner, Wendy Craig. Inspector Colgate, Gerard McDermott. Evil Under the Sun was dramatized for radio by Michael Bakewell and directed by Enid Williams.
A most satisfactory conclusion. On Monday, more daring adventures of the debonair secret agent Lucifer Box. Black Butterfly, written and read by Mark Gatiss, is on Monday in the Crime and Thriller Czar. Can't stop
music. Marking 90 years of radio in 90 seconds.
1964.
Well, one Christmas I was so excited because I was given a transistor radio. A small black Japanese item with a black leatherette case and an earphone or earpiece that looked like a National Health hearing aid.
Average choice of record for Top Gear, How Glad I Am by Nancy Wilson. And you don't know, you don't know, you don't know,
you don't know. For the first time, I could have pop music in my ears wherever I went and under my bedclothes. Because I grew up in Cornwall, we didn't have any pirate stations, no Luxembourg radio or Carolina. That stuff I didn't even know about. So you're tuning into any of the BBC stations trying to find pop music. Found it on the Light programme. That was where you would get pop programmes. And then, of course, one day I found what I thought was called Pop Gear, but actually Top Gear.
And that's it. And we hope you enjoyed it enough this week to join us next week. Right here in Top Gear.
And you can listen to all the 90 by 90 clips on the Radio 4 Extra website.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 9 o'clock, and after our short story, Sheila Delaney takes a compassionate look at growing up in Out of the Pirates Playhouse. That's in 15 minutes. That's after the first of a series of short stories commissioned in 2009 by Radio 4 from new and emerging writers. In Day Tripper by Susan Elliott Wright, a trip to the seaside offers the chance of a new beginning for a mother and son. The reader is Claire Rushbrook.
Ruth doesn't get out much, but today she makes the effort, hires a taxi and takes her son to the seaside. Today, Ruth would like to get a little colour in her cheeks because right now her skin is as pale as a cold, plucked chicken. She sits on a deck chair in front of the shabby, sky-blue beach hut she and Graham bought when they were first married, before beach huts were trendy, before Joel. She glances along the beach, conscious of her untrendy clothes. She buys these, like everything else, second-hand. The breeze catches her skirt, wafting it up to reveal pale legs. She has good legs, though her battered Clark's sandals, sensibly moulded to support the foot, do not enhance their shape. It's the sort of support you need if you've spent your teens tottering in 5-inch heels, and when time and pregnancy have pulled the beams from your insteps, leaving you flat-footed and cumbersome and prematurely middle-aged. Ruth is not unattractive. In fact, she was once regarded as something of a looker. But these days she feels insubstantial, like she is fading away. When she looks in the mirror, which is not often, she sees a face without light, a face that has gone out. She takes off her sandals and wiggles her toes down into the pebbles, feeling the cool, hard smoothness around her overheated feet. Joel is absorbed in picking up stones from one side of his body and moving them to the other. Now and then he throws back his head and laughs loudly, for no apparent reason, drawing the gaze, it seems, of every other person on the beach. As she watches Joel, Ruth notices a short, stocky man walking along the shoreline carrying a crash helmet. He sits, glancing over his shoulder and catching her eye. Inexplicably, she is discomforted. At the water's edge, children play in the surf, their squeals amplified in the thin sea air. Stones, Joel says in wonder and triumph. The children turn and look, aware for the first time of his presence. They look at his pile of stones. They take in the bottle-end glasses, the large, flabby body and the Bob the Builder swimming trunks. They probably don't notice the bulky nappy, and that's what it is, let's face it, that will need changing soon if he keeps knocking back the tango. They stop giggling and shrieking. They stand, in that way that children do, sun-hatted heads tilted to the side, arms hanging loosely, eyes in their wide faces screwed up in puzzled contemplation, staring at Joel. "Stones," Joel says, pointing in delight to the ever-growing pile at his side. A little girl of about 4, wearing a white T-shirt and shorts, puts her thumb in her mouth. Another, in bright orange, whispers something to a third, who points at Joel and says, "Why have you got those funny glasses?" "Katie, come away." A shiny, fleshy mother comes flip-flopping along the beach and takes the older girl by the hand. "Sorry," she says in Ruth's direction with an embarrassed smile and a sideways glance at Joel. "Sorry." Ruth smiles benignly. The remaining 2 children continue to stare. The smallest still has her thumb in her mouth, her index finger curled tightly around her nose. "What's your name?" she says to Joel without removing the thumb. Joel laughs loudly.